Joining me today is Mark Oldman. And Mark, we're talking today about how to drink like a billionaire. I guess one of your favorite topics. How are you today?
I'm great, Tonya. Thanks for having me on.
You're an amazing wine connoisseur, and you have so much to educate us about wine. Where do we begin?
Well, do you want me to tell you about my concept of the billionaire?
I think so. I mean, because right away you think about how to drink like a billionaire. Of course, none of us are billionaires, so how do we even get into that category?
Well, exactly. You know, it's funny, my publisher thought up the title, and it was a really accurate title, but I said to her, you know, I don't know if I want to get into that hole. You know, there are a lot of bad billionaires out there. I don't want people to think that I'm advising us to follow their lead. But really, it's drink like a billionaire, which is drink with a billionaire's confidence and drink with a billionaire's unapologetic joy, the kind of joie de vivre that I see not only billionaires, but winemakers and wine insiders. They seem to be able to relax around wine more than, let's say, my sister or my mom or a lot of my friends who have not yet made wine an obsession.
You know, it's like trying to be smart when you're out there trying to choose a wine is what first comes to mind.
Exactly. I'd like to say billionaires don't like to overspend. I mean, you might think, well, you know, someone with a lot of money, they're going to just spend recklessly. But so I've got, for example, a rosé in front of me, a $12 rosé. I've brought a bunch of, like, wines I really dig. And this is only $12. It's from Provence. I know you know a lot about cooking. So you know how great and delicate and beautiful and rose petally a fine, delicate rosé will be. And here's the thing. The billionaire knows that you can drink rosé year-round, that it's not just a summer drink.
And it doesn't have to cost $50 a bottle.
That's the most beautiful thing about it. It's $12 a bottle. And other ones rarely go above 15 or 20. Sometimes you can get them for 8. What I love about this Colombo, and this is great for your listeners, it comes in jumbo bottles like magnums and double magnums.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the book, I say that one of the hallmarks of the billionaire drinker is drinking from big bottles. But because it's rosé, you're not going to spend a lot, but everyone's going to think you spent a lot.
I have a lot of questions for you. And now you just brought up rosé, so I'm like, I don't know where to continue. But speaking of rosés, that seems to be that middle ground wine where it goes with a lot of different food. Do you agree?
Completely. And people think, oh, it's pink, it must not be serious, it must be sweet. It goes with everything. It's usually not sweet. It straddles the world between the foods we associate with white wine and those we associate with red. Now, a perfect example of that is I have in front of me a Talbot Sleepy Hollow Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir I call, like rosé, a pivot wine. It goes towards the richer foods, it goes towards the lighter foods. So, like this Sleepy Hollow, Talbot, you can have it with fish. People are, you can't have red wine with fish. Absolutely. You could. I have another wine in front of me. You could even have a Cabernet Sauvignon with fish, so long as it's not too heavy. I have in front of me this Jordan Cabernet. Jordan is, you know, kind of venerable older winery, and some of these older wineries in Napa don't make these giant blockbuster Cabernets. They make only medium to full-bodied Cabernets. So Cabernets, we call it elegance in the wine world. Well, guess what? You could pair that with fish, just like you'd pair the Pinot Noir or the Rosé with fish.
I am all about that. I don't think there should be a fast and hard rule.
Exactly. In fact, the original title for this book was Breaking the Rules of Wine, because it seems like somewhere along the line, Tonya, like there's some school marm or some disciplinarian established all these rules, but it's just not necessary. For example, I've got a wonderful blend, this Mondavi Maestro wine. You know Mondavi. It's been around forever.
Oh, yeah.
And he is the man. When I started a wine club in college many moons ago, I brought him in, and not only did he serve beautiful kind of mountain-grown California wine, lush, velvety wine, but he told us something about breaking the rules. He said what he likes to do in the summertime is he would take his beautiful, high-quality wine and every now and then cool it off, put an ice cube in it to focus the flavors and make it more refreshing. And to this day, I tell people, if Robert Mondavi himself can sometimes put ice in wine, we all can, to cool it off and make it more refreshing.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you about that because I did read that in your book. And, you know, some people would just shun to think of that, you know, ice cubes in wine. But like what you said, if he says it and he does it, then it must be okay. But it is okay even for ourselves. I mean, I've actually had that before. I just spoke with Angelina Mondavi a few weeks ago. She was talking about some of her wines. I'm lucky enough to have a bottle of this Talbot Pinot Noir Sleepy Hollow right in front of me as well.
Oh, yeah. Smell that. Smell how it has like a kind of... It smells like... I heard someone once describe this wine as autumn leaf pile. Now, I know wine can get kind of poetic and there's a lot of BS in wine, but when you smell this beautiful wine, which is from the Central Coast in California, so it's a really high quality. It's kind of where the movie Sideways was shot, not far around there, kind of east of Monterey. You smell that. That is one of the most amazing smells you can get in wine. And it's so, you know, whether it's this Pinot Noir or I've got a lovely, lush Beringer Cabernet Sauvignon from Knights Valley here, any of these sorts of wines would go great for the holidays because they're not too, too heavy and they're not too, too light. Imagine having your Talbot Sleepy Hollow or the Beringer or the Maestro Mondavi with Thanksgiving turkey. You will be the hero of your Thanksgiving feast.
Absolutely. This is my first time trying the Talbot, and it's absolutely lovely. Now, let's get into tasting and swirling and all that business. What's your opinion on that? I read about your whole swirling concept. I mean, some people can go crazy, and others don't even know how to do it. So what do you think?
Exactly. All right. So I'm going to play with my white wine here. I've got the Franciscan Cuvée Sauvage, which is a fine Chardonnay. Now, I want to swirl this a little bit to allow the vapors to release. And this is why we do it in restaurants, at home. Always swirl your wine a little bit. The problem is a lot of beginning wine drinkers, once they learn to swirl to let those vapors out, they start swirling everything. Candles, forks, knives, water cups, and they become, like a lot of other people in wine, huge bores. As my friend from Australia says, it's just dreadful. they become a dreadful wine drinkers. So what I say is swirl, but curb they swirl. Try to refrain from over-swirling. Swirl just enough to let the vapors out. Let me let you and your listeners in on a little trick. One way of really getting a good smell of your wine without having to swirl too much is right now I'm putting my hand over the Franciscan Chardonnay. So put your hand totally over the hole in the glass, the top of the glass, the rim. Put it totally over the rim. Trap in the vapors as you are swirling, and then point the wine into your nose. And you get twice as much smell. I call this swirling with a lid, and it's a way of magnifying the smells in your wine.
Now, Mark, are you swirling both reds and whites?
Exactly. You can swirl reds, whites, rosé. A great question I once asked the head of Dom Perignon, do you actually swirl bubbly too? And his answer was, yes, we do swirl bubbly because it allows us to get the better smell of this French champagne. But I said, Mr. Dom Perignon, you know, aren't you destroying the bubble? And he goes, yes, but, you know, if you drink fast enough, it does not matter. So that's what you need to do.
And
my terrible French accent.
Oh, no, you sounded great. And if you drink enough of it, who cares?
all accents sound good, no? Yeah.
So now, here's another question for you, because there's so much you know, up and down. What's your take on the whole aerating wine? You know, some people are into using aerators. Others are allowing the wine to do it themselves and yes. decanters. Like, what do you think?
The problem with the little gadgets that are aerators is that they do work, but sometimes they work too much. Basically, with aerating, we mean exposing the wine to more oxygen. So, especially in the case of red wine, it might mellow out a little bit. Sometimes red wine can be a little tannic or bitter.
Right.
And sometimes you want to expose it to more air. So I think it actually works, and it's best to do in a decanter, which means any big glass vessel with big surface area, so a lot of oxygen gets to it. Do that for an hour with a red wine you find to be kind of bitter or you expect to be a little big and bitter, and it will mellow out. To use the aerator gadget, those tend to be expensive, and sometimes you can aerate all the flavor out of it. It's very hard to do it with precision. So I, like a lot of wine experts, when we aerate, we usually do it with a big, rich red, and we do it into a glass decanter, not with a gadget.
So are you a big fan of domestic wines versus others?
I really am, and in fact, last week, I did a tasting at Stanford University in California. It was me versus another wine expert, and it was Europe versus California, and I took California, and we were serving wines like this Jordan 2012 Cabernet Sauvignon, and it just won people over, because, you know, we Americans, we're used to big flavors, fruit. One great thing for your listeners to realize is a lot of American wines tend to emphasize the fruit, the raspberries, the watermelon, the apples, the, you know, big, nice, rich flavors. Whereas French wine can be, and this is a big generalization, but French wines can be more about earth. It could be freshly tilled soil. It could be leaf pile. It could be pepper. And to our American taste, we tend to like a little more of that fruit emphasis in our wine. And that's what you find from a Jordan or a Beringer or a Talbot or a Franciscan. Then again, if I want rosé, the great pink wine that tends to be dry, I'm going to gravitate more towards a French wine like the Colombo, because Provence, you know, that sun-dappled, beautiful area of southern France, rosé's kind of spiritual homeland, and that's where everyone kind of like grew up drinking rosé before it was even trendy.
Sure.
But even when they're eight, they're drinking the rosé. So, you know, you got to look to different regions for different styles of wine.
So, is aging a big thing for you as far as, you know, aging wine?
Great question, Tonya. People ask me about that all the time. Realize only 2% of all of the world's wine is ageable, meaning it gets better with age. It gets more interesting, more complex, waves of flavors versus being a one-trick pony of wine, monochromatic, kind of boring. Realize most wine you get is not going to get more interesting with age. But this Beringer, I have laid down, that's what we billionaire equivalent or the metaphorical billionaires call aging wine. We're going to lay down our bottles. And that just means for a couple years at least, like this Beringer Knights Valley or the Jordan or the Mondavi Maestro, these are part of the 2% that after 5 years or after 10 years, they might get a little more interesting. You might smell and taste kind of other sensations you wouldn't get when they're young. So it's really, to know which wines are ageable, you have to kind of read up on it or ask your local wine store who is knowledgeable, wine merchant, and say, well, will this improve with age? But I often say one rule of thumb is if it's over $25 or $30 and it's red, chances are you can give it a couple years and it might get more interesting. Now, that's not all wines, but if it's of a certain price and it has a certain track record, like a Mondavi, which is known. I mean, Mondavi is one of these California wines where, you know, they're still drinking wines of theirs from the 70s. I just had a Mondavi 76, and it was beautiful. And believe it or not, there are people out there who say, California wines don't age, and that is such a misconception.
Well, now, I know you got the Georges Dubuff Award a while back. So what is your take on Beaujolais Nouveau, since we're coming up onto the end of November when the whole thing is released?
I dig it, but again, you're talking to a guy who is from New Jersey, and when he gave his National Honor Society president speech, I had strawberry wine coolers back when they were in fashion in the 80s before delivering the speech to the National Honor Society. So I like easy, happy juice when the occasion calls for it. I also am lucky that I have real billionaires sharing with me $15,000 to $20,000 a bottle of wines, and I can appreciate those. So Beaujolais Nouveau, I put in the happy juice category. It's fun, it's easy, it's not complex. It's not for aging. It's for quaffing. Knock it back. The Australians say it's smashable. That's their word for wine like that. Now, the key thing to know is Beaujolais Nouveau is the happy, simple stuff that comes out in November.
Right.
Regular Beaujolais, Beaujolais Cru, which is not, Beaujolais is not big on the bottle. You just have to know the Cru villages.
Mm-hmm.
But Bruyi, Morgon, Moulin-au-Vent, go to your local wine store, ask for a Beaujolais Cru, and those are going to be more interesting. They're available year-round. They're not expensive, and they're a great pinch hitter for Pinot Noir. You're going to get like 80% of the joy of a lovely Pinot Noir, but pay only about 30% of the price.
It's interesting. Mark, do you have a website we can check out?
Absolutely. If you go to Mark Oldman, markoldman.com, you can get all sorts of free videos and free content. Find out more about the book.
I know you're always at different festivals and you speak all over the country. Where can we see you next?
Oh, yeah. One really cool festival I'll be doing in February, first annual, the Brooklyn Food and Wine Festival.
Oh.
You know, no sleep till Brooklyn, you know. And Brooklyn's become so fashionable, they're just putting in this really high-quality food and wine festival. But, of course, I'll be at all the other ones. I'll be my 12th year at the Aspen Food and Wine Classic.
Yeah.
The Austin Food and Wine Festival. So I love it, and it gives me a chance to kind of be out there and talk to people and find out what's really moving their needle in the wine world.
Well, you know, Mark, I go to the Boston Wine Expo every year. I never see you there.
You know, I went to that many years. I even headlined it one year.
No kidding.
I need to go back. You just, when I go next time, I want you to get me some nice thick socks. Because I know it's in January. And a nice cable knit sweater. Because I think the last time I was there, the newscasters, there was a minus on the Fahrenheit degree.
Oh, yeah.
I'm definitely willing to go back. It's a wonderful festival.
Yeah, you definitely have to bundle up to go to that festival. We got snowed out a couple years ago. It was pretty intense.
But, I could imagine.
You know, that's the way we New Englanders are, though. We still trudge through and enjoy our vino.
you're from hardy stock, but you know how to have fun.
Absolutely.
That's the best combination.
We're talking with Mark Oldman about how to drink like a billionaire. Hey, thanks so much for your time. It's really been fun and educating on wine, Mark.
Tonya, so much fun. Thanks for having me on.